This evening I'd like to talk about the East Asian economic miracle, and I want to focus on innovation. And I want to look at the innovation paths and patterns in East Asia, of which there are many. And I want to make two main arguments regarding innovation in East Asia. And they're both concern policy. That's the subject of my talk this evening. The first argument I want to make is that I believe it's analytically wrong and very, very misleading in a real sense to draw direct lessons, policy models from Asia and then apply them to developing countries, to other developing countries. There is huge variety and difference within and across Asia, which I'll mention, which often goes ignored in this. The second argument I want to make is a more positive one. While you can't draw direct lessons, I think there are some extremely interesting and useful insights from the East Asian and the Southeast Asian experience for other developing countries, which, if used in a sensible way, can actually help them build distinctive and original paths for development. They don't follow the leader, but they nevertheless use the evidence, use the information from Asia to build their own path and to chart their own path to development. And so that's what I want to do tonight. I want to convince you of those two things, if you didn't already know those two things. So, okay, what is the policy issue I'm talking about here? Well, over the past 25 years or so, we've all become aware of the East Asian, Southeast Asian growth miracle. There's no doubt about that. It has been an astonishing world economic event. The question is, how should other countries interpret this experience? Many people think, you know, using common sense and catch-up theory, think, well, you know, others should follow, should imitate the Asian countries. And you often hear this in policy circles. And I'll give you some examples. The World Bank, the OECD, the United Nations, the European Union, academics around the world, governments, consultants, they all often draw on the Asian experience, quite naturally you might think, to suggest paths and lessons for poorer countries, even African countries. So what I'm arguing is, while direct lessons and policies can't be transferred, there are some interesting ways of thinking about this which I think are quite useful. Here are some of the typical policy recommendations we often hear which relate to Asia. The first one is export-led growth paths. That's a very fundamental part of the Asian experience. Outward-looking orientation. Open markets to foreign investment, imports, privatization, deregulation, business-friendly policies, the Washington consensus type of argument. We often hear that high technology production is very important. Government support for knowledge-based industries and industrial clusters are a more recent version of policy making. And we also hear about science and technology parks as explanations for their development. Drawing lessons in this way, I really do think, is a very dangerous thing to do. I think it reflects a deeply flawed understanding of how development occurs. And even worse, many of these lessons aren't even, they actually run contrary to the Asian evidence, the Asian experience. Some of the explanations occurred well after the takeoff, and well after the Asian economic miracle. So if we look at Korea and Taiwan, for example, they operated closed internal markets for the first 20 or 25 years of their growth phase. And if you go to Korea today, you won't see any foreign cars, or you might see one in Korea. But generally speaking, you won't see any foreign cars. The market's still closed today to foreign cars. Most of the exports from this region for the first 20 years or so was not high technology at all. It was low technology produced on the basis of simple assembly production. So for a long period of time, production was low technology. And most science and technology parks came well after the growth phase, the miracle phase, and had very little to do with it in the main. I wanted to just to remind people here who may not know, the Asian experience is really astonishing. It's a major economic feature of the second half of the 20th century. If you just go back to 1962 and look at Taiwan and Korea, they had GNP per capita levels of the poorer African nations, not the wealthier ones, the poorer ones. Within about 25 years, they'd moved up the rankings by 47 places and 55 places, respectively. And that took them above the Latin American countries and many other poor countries around the world, which they were behind before. When you look at company growth, business growth, it's much, much faster than the GNP growth. GNP growth, 8 to 10%. Company growth could be 20 or 30% per annum for extended periods of time. So really astonishing growth and development going on. Similar story in Hong Kong and Singapore. And then what you found was the low-cost assembly, which began in what are called the Four Dragons, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore, then migrated to Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and Vietnam, the Philippines, leading to their export-led growth. And then more recently, that low-cost assembly has moved to China. So it really is an astonishing story. And as a result of all of this, much of world growth and trade has shifted to the East and Southeast Asian region. And now the research I've been doing has been mostly on firms. I mean, most of the original research I've done has been looking at the businesses, the firms, to see how they acquire technology, how they overcome their barriers into international markets. I mean, I have done work on trade and government policy issues and the macroeconomy, but that was a bit of a gap when I started. The thing about firms is that it's not markets. It's not abstract markets that export and acquire technology and learn to do production. It's firms. And so there was a big gap at the time. So I was interested in how did these firms in East Asia acquire this technology? How did they begin to catch up with the leaders on the international stage? And you can think of them in terms of latecomer firms, rather like me coming to this lecture 10 years late. And you can define them. You can't define me in these terms. You can define them in terms of two types of disadvantage. The first disadvantage is these firms are dislocated from international sources of technology, from science, from the top universities. And we all think that's very important for competing. The second problem, which is equally daunting, is that they're cut off, dislocated from demanding users, leading international markets, what Michael Porter calls clusters, what other people call networks, and so on, industrial districts. And so these latecomer firms, they're distinct, obviously distinct from leaders in the US and Japan and so on, but they're also distinct from followers, because followers are in the developed country context. They may even have advantages over leaders. We've all heard of fast followers, for example. So they're not followers, they are latecomers. They have really serious disadvantages in getting into international markets and acquiring technology. Today, there are many hundreds of latecomer firms which are very successful and export into international markets. Most of them are not heard of. Most of them aren't known. The most famous one is probably Samsung. Samsung's a very large one, but there's also hundreds of small and medium-sized ones as well. Samsung is a Korean company in this splendid new headquarters in Seoul. It entered electronics, which is its biggest, most successful area, in 1969, making, I recall transistor radios and black and white televisions, very simple products. And it moved into this assembly from insurance, property and paper, cement and things like that. It was a conglomerate, low-tech conglomerate before that. By 2004, it was spending $4.6 billion per annum on R&D, 1,600 US patents, 123,000 employees, 17 R&D centers around the world, a world leader in semiconductor DRAMs, mobile phones, laptop computers, and other electronic products. So an astonishing achievement. This is probably the leading latecomer firm, but there are many others. How did it achieve what it had achieved? Well, one way of looking at this is to divide it into rough approximate stages of development, phases, if you like. And I like to see it in terms of three phases. Companies like Samsung, Hyundai, Lucky Gold Star, Tatung from Taiwan, Acer from Taiwan, they began this assembling very simple goods like Samsung, and supplying foreign transnational corporate buyers. So they were buying big, supplying big American and Japanese corporations, usually under subcontracting arrangements under the OEM system, what they call OEM in the region, which stands for Original Equipment Manufacturer. And what that is that the transnational buyer gives the supplier the design, the technology, the order, and in return, the transnational gets low-cost production capacity. So it helps the transnational compete with other transnationals. So these transnationals were getting hooked on this low-cost, very efficient assembly of products. The other thing the transnationals do is that they brand and distribute the products, which gets the latecomer firm over the market entry barrier, gets them into international markets without a well-known brand, without their own distribution channels. So you see in all these different product areas listed here, you see enormous amounts of goods. Most of the telephones you would buy here in Britain would be made probably in Taiwan or China now, for example. The second phase is slightly different. The second phase is what I call the manufacturing innovation stage. It's gone beyond assembly, and it's actually learning to improve the manufacturing of these products on a very large scale. So they're mastering manufacturing process innovation at this stage. This is the mid-1970s to about the mid-1990s, so it's a long period of time. They're also learning much, much more about product innovation in order to do the manufacturing better, in order to improve the manufacturing. So still, the transnational corporations are buying these products, branding these products, and distributing these products, which means that the transnationals are still gaining most of the value added from the production. So under this system, it's a harsh system. The local firms, the latecomer firms, get very little of the value added to begin with. The third phase, which is from the mid-1990s onwards, is, if you like, the innovation stage. It's where the companies are doing more research and development, where they're doing more of their own product design. They've built their own distribution networks and brands. So you've heard of Samsung now, you've heard of Lucky Gold Star, you've heard of these other companies, Hyundai and so on. They've actually caught up with the world leaders at this stage. They're actually no longer latecomer firms. They are now competing on the international stage with the market leaders. So I would say that most firms haven't reached this stage. Even the leading firms like Samsung only have two or three products which they could claim are world-beating products. A lot of what they do is still basic OEM, still manufacturing and assembly. In fact, in the early 1990s, 70 to 80% of total Korean electronics export was still OEM. So it was still basic manufacturing. It wasn't this stage yet. So this is probably the tip of the iceberg of all the production they do. There are other problems. even the strongest firms are still weak in software, they're weak in basic research, they have poor capital goods technology. If you look at the trade figures into Taiwan and Korea, you see the trade is roughly in balance because of the huge imports of capital goods, because they can't make them themselves. a few more points about the nature of this innovation. It's wrong to say that all firms followed these stages, these paths. They didn't. It's just a very, very rough approximation. It's an average of what happened across a wide number of sectors. Acer, for example, the Taiwanese firm, Acer, it entered in 1976 with just 11 employees, and now it's a $14 billion Taiwanese corporation. It's number two worldwide in notebook computers. So not all firms went that way, but quite a few did. The innovation you see is incremental innovation on the whole. It's not radical innovation. It's hard work. It's a long, hard slog of learning technology, as Martin Bell would say. It's not an overnight success. Well, after 30 years, they became an overnight success. It's that kind of story. So it's behind the R&D frontier. The R&D, they do a lot of R&D, but it's not yet really responsible for most of their competitiveness. It is in a few areas, but not mainly. So having said that, I would say that if you look hard, you can find some very interesting new business models in Asia, in China, in Taiwan, in Korea. You see them doing things that no one else has done before, often on the basis of specialist technological niches. They will do something with great precision and great depth, which no one has done before. So in terms of business models, they are innovative as well. How do we understand this? How best to understand this? If you come to SPRU to do a master's in innovation management, this is probably the first model you will learn, and I recommend all of you to come and do this course in SPRU. It's a wonderful course. This is the standard, if you like, the MIT model of what leadership firms do when they innovate. This is the model that you start off with in lesson one of the innovation management course. Here you've got the rate of innovation on this axis, and along here you've got time or stage of development. Product innovation begins with research and development, and many products are produced for the marketplace. As the market selects among the products, eventually the market fixes on a design standard, what's sometimes called a dominant design. At that stage, process innovation, manufacturing process of innovation, becomes much more important. Firms grow larger, and they're competing on the basis of manufacturing. So product innovation slows down, and process innovation gets more and more important. There's a shakeout of small firms at this point, according to the theory, and firms become larger and larger, and the industry becomes oligopolized, and you move from research and development intensive here through to manufacturing assembly intensive here. You move from the early stage of the product life cycle here to the mature late stage of the product life cycle here. So that's the standard model by our colleagues at MIT, Jim Atterback and Abernathy and so on, Michael Tushman. Now, what did the Asian firms do? Well, they did exactly the opposite. They started here in the 1960s in simple assembly, in manufacturing. They moved into manufacturing innovation in the 1970s. In the 1980s, they began doing product design. And in the 2000s and 1990s, they begin doing serious research and development. So they've, if you like, reversed the normal cycle of innovation, which is supposed to go on. And this was a very innovative thing to do. No one had done this before on such a scale. I'm not aware of any country leading its whole development path on a model which reverses the normal model. So when you talk about innovation in East Asia, you are dealing with a very different kind of innovation from what went before. And that's very important when we start thinking about other countries in just a moment. right now, in fact. Okay, so when we think about policy lessons, I'm trying to keep an eye on the time. I think we're all right for time. When we think about policy lessons, it's very tempting to think, look, why shouldn't Latin America do this sort of thing? Why shouldn't Africa do this sort of thing? You know, Asia can do it. Why can't they do it? Same sort of wage rates in some of these countries. And if you look at the World Bank's Doing Business program, it argues that the poorer countries should adopt policies of the most advanced Asian and the advanced countries, which they call best practice. And they say that it's a good idea to adopt the property rights, the business startup advice, the liberalization of markets, the export-led growth patterns of Asia. In fact, they calculate that more than 2% could be added immediately to the growth rates of the most difficult countries to do business, which are the poorest countries in Africa, if they adopted the practice of the leading nations. So that's a typical example. It's not the only one, but it's a typical example of the follow the leader policies, which are often recommended. And my point here is, even if they had the experience of Asia right, which they often don't, it would still be wrong to recommend the follow the leader policies. And I to try and explain the argument, I want to go back a bit to the debate in the 1950s and 1960s. And there was a very similar academic and policy debate going on then. Walt Whitman Rostow was a famous economist. He also proposed very similar policies for the developing world as we hear today, follow the leaders. His classic text became a kind of standard. It was taught in most universities. It sold more than 250,000 copies in the first edition. It got translated into 50 languages. And it became conventional popular wisdom at the time. He had a growth model for developing countries based on the stages of growth and takeoff of the now developed countries. And he used this for policy making lessons. And I think it's useful here to quote from Rostow at the time. It is useful, as well as roughly accurate, to regard the process of development now going forward in Asia, the Middle East and Africa and Latin America as analogies to the stages of the preconditions and takeoff of other societies in the late 18th, 19th and early 20th centuries. So it's a garbled way of saying it, but what he's basically saying is what you're seeing today is what we saw before. We're seeing similar patterns of growth repeating themselves. And it's a very similar agenda when we think about Asia today, that we should take the lessons of Asia and apply them to other countries. Now, my favorite economic historian is Alexander Gershenkron, and he took issue, he wasn't the only one, but he took issue with this argument. He said this is wrong. It's ahistorical and it's ill-conceived. And Gershenkron, he was a Russian-born economist but became famous in Harvard, he studied European latecomer industrialization, and he had a very different set of ideas on development than the policy wisdom of the time and today. He also saw industrialization as a stage-like process, rather like I did when I looked at those firms in Korea and Taiwan. But he said there's no automatic stages of development, and latecomers did not and could not pass through the same stages other countries had passed through. And why was that? Precisely because other countries have passed through those stages, they've changed the technology and market circumstances. And in addition, each country has its own set of distinctive resources, capabilities, skills, and so on, and its own stage of backwardness. And that alone would shape and influence any potential growth path. So it was wrong to draw lessons in the way that we were saying before. Here's a quote from Gershenkron. from his famous book, which was written in 1962. And he's talking about his own interpretation of stages. He says, this interpretation of stages differs essentially from the various efforts in stage making, the common feature of which was the assumption that all economies were supposed to regularly pass through the same individual stages as they moved along the road of economic progress. So Rostow was at pains to assert that the process of industrialization repeated itself from country to country. So he's completely rejecting this notion that you should imitate, follow the leader when you see other successful developing countries. That's not all he said. He said many things, and this is another very important thing he said. He argued that if you look at Europe, he argued that the industrial development of Europe is not a series of mere repetitions of the first industrialization, but an orderly system of graduated deviations from that industrialization. So he brings in this concept of graduated deviation. And he said the higher the degree of backwardness, the more discontinuous the development is likely to be. So discontinuity is another key feature in his interpretation, in his model. And when you think of China today, you think of the way China's developing, you see lots of discontinuity in the way they're developing. this idea of graduated deviation, when you look at the Asian experience, I would argue that it conforms very closely to this idea of graduated deviation. You see, Japan was the first to develop. Then the four dragons entered with significant differences: South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore. They were then followed by the second-tier countries of Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, Philippines, and so on. And they didn't do subcontracting. They grew on the basis of foreign direct investment and transnational-led exports, which is very similar to China today. China then enters, combining many of the old strategies of East and Southeast Asia, exports through foreign multinationals in Southeast Asia, large-scale subcontracting within East Asia, but with some added features, radical new features. The large local market, hugely important for China to use its large indigenous market as leverage over foreign investors and so on and so forth. Huge supplies of cheap technical labour in China, which is very different from these other cases. The other concept he introduced is the idea of substitution of missing prerequisites. What he said was, against Rostow, he said that it's not a case of latecomers following a standard or investing in a standard set of prerequisites or preconditions. It's a case of substituting for those missing prerequisites. So he said that European history should be seen as a pattern of substitution of missing prerequisites, governed by, again, the prevailing and changing degree of backwardness. And I would say that if you look at Asia, you see precisely that going on in Asia in the last 30 or 40 years. And I'll just give three quick examples. The one missing vital precondition for growth was a strong entrepreneurial and managerial capacity in these countries. Well, in Korea, to get over this problem, the state sponsored these very large corporations and helped grow a new class of managers which didn't exist before. In Singapore, they didn't believe that would work in Singapore. So in Singapore and Malaysia as well, they gave subsidies for the foreign transnational subsidiaries to come in and bring in that managerial and entrepreneurial capacity. So that's one substitution. Another substitution is the large internal market. These countries all had very small internal markets to begin with, and some of them still have fairly small markets. So what did they do? They use export-led growth through the subcontracting system to access American markets and European markets. So again, they're substituting the missing prerequisite of the industrializers before them. access to advanced technology, research and development, and all that kind of thing. Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand got access to technology through foreign direct investment. So they're substituting, again, what was evident in the United States and Japan at the time. So they're substituting. In Korea, Taiwan, they use subcontracting to get access to technology. So you see a substitution of missing prerequisites. And the final point I'd like to make concerning Gershenkron was his view of the role of innovation. He argued that innovation was vital for the development process. And here's another quotation. The very concept of substitution is premised upon creative innovating activity, that is to say, upon something that is inherently unpredictable with our normal apparatus of research. So he's saying that you should expect to see innovation, you should expect to see experimentation, you should expect to see creativity when you're looking for successful economic development. It's essentially an innovative activity. All those things I told you, all those substitutions were innovative strategies, innovative activities. So we should, and he wasn't the only one, Abramovitz in his famous article put it another way. He said that you should expect to see as much innovation, variety and difference in the catching up development process as you do at the very frontier of innovation. And I think he's absolutely right in saying that. So, coming back to the topic, a new agenda for developing countries. What does all this mean for other countries? What's the agenda? First of all, it's worth saying it again. Few, if any, direct historical lessons, models, for the reasons Gershenkron pointed out. Export-led growth is not open to all. Electronics as an industry, IT as an industry, is probably too crowded now with the entry of China. Probably useful to think in terms of missing requisites and how they could be substituted using specific local capabilities and resources. And it's probably useful to think about that in experimenting and developing scenarios for development in different countries. This calls for rejecting follow the leader thinking and approaches and searching for new innovative paths which complement other growth paths. So we should be thinking of paths which complement the Asian growth experience and the developed countries' poles of growth. It shouldn't be imitating, it should be complementing. And it should always build on a country's history, historical capabilities, its opportunities. And always expect innovation and distinctiveness as a core part of any future growth path. To finish off, I'd like to just briefly talk to two areas of research which I think are very consistent with the sorts of arguments I've been making. They're not necessarily directly come from that at all, but they're very exciting new research programs that we're all involved many of us are involved in SPRU and Centrum and outside. The first one is the Task Force on Rethinking Industrial Policies, which is led by Joe Stiglitz in Colombia. What that is doing is questioning all this conventional wisdom around development, particularly the Washington consensus and the augmented Washington consensus and the George Bush approach to development. And there's a program there on Latin America, Africa, poor parts of Asia and India and so on, looking at rethinking development in that way. And my area within this is entrepreneurship and innovation and looking at the Asian experience. But there's other people taking a radical approach, looking at technology, looking at investment, looking at trade, looking at intellectual property. And there's a new book coming out this year from this program, which I urge you all to read. And it's What Should Be Done in the Post-Washington Consensus Post-Bush era for countries that are in development difficulties and arrested development. The second program that I wanted to flag this evening is called the Latin American Vision. We call it LA Vision. It's a program centered in the Freeman Center with members from SPRU and Centrum. It's already got 29 academic members. I just checked yesterday before I came here. 29 academic members. It's led by Carlotta Perez, Martin Bell, Matias Ramirez, Fernando Perini, and many, many other people. It's not actually led by anybody. It's a Latin American kind of thing. representative, very democratic. Representatives of several countries of Latin America all contributing. They've got specialists, interdisciplinary skills. They're examining, identifying, testing credible new development paths within and across Latin America. The idea here, the ambition is to search for new paths to development through our research, which combines local resource advantages with high value added export opportunities, so moving up the value chain, rather like the Asians did in electronics, but in other sectors, which makes sense in this region. But also, today, if you're talking about growth paths, you need to think about sustainability, you need to think about employment creation and fairness. The days are gone, I think, for where growth for its own sake can be justified. And even on a commercial level, this agenda, the environment, the sustainability agenda, holds out huge new commercial opportunities for people who think about that. It's going beyond the conventional import substitution versus export-led growth type of debate towards new paths which complements and benefits from Asia and other growth patterns. The ambition here is to frame the research agenda with policymakers so that they can shape a vision of the future and help move towards something viable and exploit windows of opportunity, which is the term Carlotta Perez uses to describe the opportunities which can be made available through new technological paradigms, for example. One might think this is fanciful or impossible, but I would say to you that no one foresaw the growth of East and Southeast Asia. No one predicted it. It was completely it was a complete surprise. In the 1950s and 60s, much of Asia, including South Korea, was written off by observers as Confucian, too family-oriented, too backward to develop. I've got reports by the American aid agency saying Koreans don't turn up for work and things like this in the early 1960s. Today, of course, Confucianism, family orientation is a positive feature of economic development. But at the time, it wasn't. So there's every chance that the LA Vision program can achieve its aims if it does this rejecting of conventional policy wisdom and really does build and chart an innovative new growth path. So thank you.